Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 101 of Season 5 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Travis Bowe of the Watchmen Minute and the very recent, possibly actually working today, the Minute of Thieves podcast. Or did I get that
right? Yeah, that's correct.
Welcome back, Travis.
Thanks.
Always fun having you on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, you know, and you know, I get my art from you also, so that works too. I don't have you on only for that. You know, I do enjoy talking to you.
Well, likewise.
But I love your art, and you know, I'm glad that I get to use it. So that's the way it works. So minute 101 begins with John responding to Vito and ends with Holly asking for some divine intervention. We ended things on Friday with, it was last week was a crazy week with everything that went on. The week actually revealed some of the twists in the movie. Also, we got to see some of the craziness of the movie. You know, John should be dead now because anyone who opens fire on a policeman in a police station, the odds are someone's going to shoot you, like we've seen in The Terminator. You know, I mean, The Terminator took out, I think, like 17 policemen, if I remember correctly. You know, if you're shooting blanks, yeah, you're still going to probably get shot. I think I mentioned it last week. I think there were like eight cops that drew their weapons. So I don't know if that's like they have good discipline or they're just idiots, you know.
Yeah.
So, could be either.
John has that. John was wearing plot armor in those minutes. So
yes. Hey, well, plot armor works, especially in the Die Hard verse. You know, and it makes sense. And so, you know, John became friends again with Lorenzo, and Lorenzo started showing how great of a he started showing that he actually can be a leader.
Yeah.
You know, at the end on Friday, and then they get in the car, and then he introduces him to his brother, and it turns out it's Vito, the guy who John met at the beginning. He was in the first week, you know, where he actually gave John a ticket he didn't give him a ticket, he towed his car. And then, you know, John met him a little bit later on. That's Robert Costanzo. I think that's Costanzo. This minute actually begins with John looking at him after Vito says to him, Merry Christmas. John looks at him and you can see that he's like, oh, I can't believe that this is what I'm going through again. You know, so John acknowledges Vito with a, you know, says hi and gives him like a slight Bruce Willis smirk along the way. I mean, like, I can't believe this crap. You know, that type of thing.
It's things like this keep happening to John. Like he finds himself in another Christmas terrorist situation, and now he finds himself back with this jerk cop.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we can call Vito a jerk cop at this point, because now we don't know. No, let's put it this way. You know, in the first scene, John was wrong. There's no question about that. You don't leave your car out on the curb, you know, and run into the airport a few hours before your wife's plane is supposed to land, and then run back and expect them not to have towed your car from a no parking zone. Okay, that's the first of all. I mean, again, I'm not 100% trying to defend Vito here, but you know, John. I mean, it's a great plot device to do this, to have him meet him at the beginning. You know, you have you know, Chekhov's gun and Chekhov's all these different things. So here we have Chekhov's Vito. You know, the guy that we never thought would be back, and now he's back, and John has to be friendly with him. You know, and then we see a shot via the windshield as the car starts to drive away. And then the police car just smashes into this taxi, you know, that basically cuts him off. Now, again, it's really hard to tell here who's at fault, because I think they both are. I mean, obviously, we'll just blame Thornburg. You know, Thornburg's the one who's causing all the trouble here.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, John doesn't know that, but that, that or and probably Lorenzo doesn't either. But you know, and then Lorenzo screams out, "Shit!" And God damn it to hell, move that piece of shit. And then the cab driver screams back, "What's the matter with you?" And then you hear him say, "I didn't even see you, man." And then Lorenzo starts screaming at him again, "Will you move that goddamn piece of shit out of here?" And then he looks over into the car and goes, "Vito, get the f out of the car and get your ass in gear and help me for Christ's sake. Will you get move that car back right now, lady?"
Yeah, this just starts off with
So
Dennis Franz just screaming.
that's right. That's right. We thought he was amicable, you know, from the end of last week, and here he just goes off on a tirade, just starts yelling at this cabbie, you know. And I mean, I find it funny the way the cabbie is responding. "I didn't even see you." What do you mean I didn't see you? You
Didn't
know,
see the flashing lights
there
or
are tons of. That's right.
I'm looking.
No, there were
There's
no
a
flashing
like
lights.
wide
Where was
shot a
everyone
couple of
flashing
seconds
lights?
later. There's like 16 cop cars, you know. So this cabbie should have been
That's right.
aware that drives.
Yeah, but well, you do have the fake snow. You have the fake snow all around. So, you know, I mean, you know about that, that when they made this movie, that every place that they went to go film were places that you normally would have tons of snow, and they
Oh,
couldn't get a
really?
break. There was no
I
real
could.
snow. They filmed near Seattle, near Denver, in the UP of Michigan. No snow whatsoever during the winter of
Wow.
1990.
I
Whenever they
could
were
tell
filming.
throughout the movie that there was a lot of fake snow. I didn't know
Yes.
what time of year they were filming this, or I knew about some of the locations.
Right. They filmed, I think, between November 89 and May
Oh, yeah.
90. And then the movie came out, you know, July 4th week, because July 4th that year was, I think, a Wednesday. And the reason I remember that is because I went to a special screening of it on Tuesday night, on the 3rd, and then I saw it again at the first showing on the 4th. You know, it's one of
Nice.
two movies that I've seen back to back in the theater, you know, night and then the following day. The other one was Jurassic Park, when that came out a few years later.
Nice.
So yeah, it was very cool seeing this twice in a row, which is why I have a soft spot for this installment of Die Hard. It's hard to say which is my favorite of the trilogy, but you know, this one still has a soft spot for me because it was the first one I saw in the theater. The original Die Hard I never saw in the theater, so this is the first one that I saw in the theater. And again, I had the 1-2 punch of seeing it, you know, day after day. You know, that type of, what's your history with this? Do you remember?
This one would have just been whenever I was allowed to watch it at home on VHS. And I had seen the first one, that one was, despite the rating, I was allowed to watch this one, with the first Die Hard. We watched it fairly often. This one we just never really watched, more than a couple times. Like, I've probably only seen this less than a handful of times, and haven't watched this in easily 20, 25 years. It was just kind of, just
Really? Until you just rewatched it now, you hadn't seen it in
easily.
25 years? Did you remember
I
everything that
remembered it,
happens? Did you like remember some of the twists?
I wasn't surprised by the twists, but I couldn't remember, like, other than the actors being in it, I couldn't remember what the villains, what he was after, what he was trying to do. So all the stuff with the general was felt, like I didn't know where some of that was going. But I remembered William Sadler pretty well and his character and what he was kind of up to. I didn't really remember John Amos being in it, so he was kind of a surprise to see. And then it was like, oh, okay, now I remember him and his team and what, that twist.
Well, you can talk about the twist because it happened last week. So, you know, and this week we'll talk about it a lot also. You know, we sort of, you know, the cat is out of the bag, even though this is something with spoilers anyway. You know, we assume that whoever's listening to this 33 years after the movie came out, you know, has, you know, that they've probably seen it and that they know what type of twists there are.
But I realized watching
Yeah.
this that it falls into the same formula that I have with Back to the Future and Indiana Jones, where I love the first one. The first one is a great movie. The second one, I'm, you know, I enjoy it, but I don't care for it as much. And the third is my favorite. So the Die Hard trilogy falls into that same formula as those other two franchises.
Okay. Have you seen Die Hard with a Vengeance? Did you see that in the
theater?
No,
that would have been a home. Yeah, that one you also probably, what was that, 94, 96, 95?
95. No, it was 95. Was 95.
12, you know. But I saw it as soon as we could rent it, you know.
Yeah. No, we all can look back and say that there are movies that our parents probably shouldn't let us see when we were younger. I mean, I still remember that I saw The Breakfast Club when I was 11. Okay. And I think to myself, I would not show my 11-year-old daughter The Breakfast Club. You know, it's like, I have trouble thinking about letting my 16-year-old son see The Breakfast Club. You know, there's a lot of things going on there that I don't really know. But, you know, like my parents apparently just didn't really care. They didn't look into it as much, I guess. I don't know. I'm grateful for that because, you know, I got to see all these great movies. I mean, I saw Police Academy in 1984 when I was 10 in the theater also. You know, and that's a movie that also has nudity. So I don't know. I don't know what was wrong with my parents, but again, you know.
Yeah.
How can I complain?
I kind of went down a little deep dive in this minute. There was something that stood out. Something that stood out to me that I wanted to look into. It was like seeing John and Vito and Carmine. Is that?
Yes. Carmine Lorenzo.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Seeing the three of them crammed into that front seat of the car, I got to thinking about bench seats and like, when did bench seats die out in passenger cars? And turns out they lasted a lot longer than I remember. Chrysler did away with them in 2004. Ford held out until 2011, and Chevy announced in late 2012 that the 2013 Chevy Impala would be their last passenger car with an optional bench seat.
Wow.
You could get the bench seat, you know, for $200, you could, you know, get that added on.
Can you still do it today or that you can't do that anymore?
No. In that 2013 model, you could get one.
Right.
It looks like in some trucks and SUVs, you can still get a bench seat. And typically they are, I guess, what's called like a 40-20-40, where that middle typically will fold forward and become, you know, a console of its own kind of. When it's not in use, it'll have cup holders and that sort of thing. But I watched a video from CNBC called What Happened to Front Bench Seats in Cars? And it briefly goes through like the history of the bench seat and why they even, you know, were a thing to begin with. And it was like, you know, back then cars were, you know, for the family, you know, you typically, you know, you had one car and
you needed that extra space for another kid.
Yeah, you cram everyone in there, you take them for vacations and road trips, and then as time went by and people traveled more for work, or they would eventually just, you know, every adult had their own car, so the car became a personal thing, and you wanted all your stuff around you, so that's why the bench seats started to give way to the bucket seats, and then having a console kind of around you where you could put your drink holders, put papers in a little compartment, you know, whatever. And then eventually, like, you know, as time went on, you know, even like having a transmission in a car, you know, manual transmissions are going away, are almost all completely gone away.
Right.
And so you don't need that center console kind of shifting area. You can have your shift, you know, my truck has a shift knob on the dash. I just turn it to whatever gear I want to be in. And, you know, so with electric shifting and things like that, we're almost more able to go back to a bench seat because we don't need all that stuff
It's true. You know?
And I guess some.
And you should have your kid hold a cup of coffee.
Yeah, there you go. Concept cars are starting to come back with bench designs because they are, especially with like electric cars, where you don't even need to save all that space for the transmission.
Wow.
Yeah, there's more room, you know, in cars, you know, in the future, I guess. So who knows? Maybe John McClane will find himself crammed into a, you know, police cruiser with a couple sweaty cops again in the future.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, also, you know, both Vito and Carmine are pretty big, you know.
Yeah.
So they really had to squeeze the three of them in there. Mm-hmm. You know, regardless, which I guess is why Carmine yells at Vito to get out of the car, because it's probably not easy for Vito to get out from the middle. You know, I can understand that.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Thank you for that that deep dive. I didn't even think to look for that. You know, I usually look for things that are visible, and it never even dawned on me to think about that, which is great. So thank you very much for giving us that.
Yeah. It was just that image of the three of them crammed in there next to each other, like right after they hit the cab. There's a nice couple seconds with them.
Yeah.
You know, it just looked funny.
Yeah. No, it's great. Great, great. And then, so John, you know, while Vito and Lorenzo are Vito and Carmine, because I guess Vito is a Lorenzo also. So the two of them are both screaming and yelling at the cab driver. Actually, when Vito gets out, he looks like one of the Three Stooges, the way he's moving around. You know, maybe Curly. I don't know. Looks a little strange.
I think he like kicks the back of the cab and kind of bangs the window a little bit.
That's right.
Back in the era where you could just hit someone
and
in
then his
car.
And then his hat like flies off as he's doing that also. And
oh, does it?
Yeah. And John is just, he's had enough. He needs to get out of there.
Yeah.
And he just looks around to try to find some sort of savior.
A solution.
Yeah. Something to help him. And he just happens to see, Sam Coleman, and he hears her. And I'm really surprised that he's able to hear her over all this commotion, you know, where we hear her say, right here, get that. You know, like she's pointing to her cameraman, telling him what he should be filming and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, then he starts screaming over to her. He goes, hey, Coleman, Sam Coleman. Hey, Coleman. And then she looks around. And again, they're really far apart. And she can hear him perfectly. And he can hear her perfectly. And then she goes, oh, hi.
the hi is really misplaced.
Yeah.
It's like, but I like that few seconds before that with John getting out of the car and just standing there, and like everything around him is panic, but he is, you know, he's not freaking out, but you can tell like he's looking for that. Like you said, he's looking for that way out. What can he do next? Mm-hmm. You know, he needs to figure something out. But yeah, I really like that couple seconds of him just not dealing with the cab driver and everything that Vito and Carmine are getting into, but just like he's going to keep moving and he's going to figure out what to do next.
That's right.
I really like that he spots Sam.
And they give us a great shot while they're in the middle of this conversation between the two of them, you know, where we see where the police car is and we see tons of people that are crossing, that are walking, you know, on the road. And so we can see the really far distance between John and Sam, but they can still both hear each other perfectly. They got their mics on properly, I guess, or whatever. And if you notice, you see that there's a guy walking, carrying a pair of skis.
Okay. Yeah, that stood out to me.
And then a few seconds later, we'll see another person carrying skis. So it made me start wondering, okay, so this is obviously a guy who probably was planning on going somewhere to go skiing, or because the odds are he's not on a plane that landed at this point. Okay. But he's carrying his skis in a way that, you know, when you travel, you wouldn't be carrying the skis this way. You know, so I actually looked up how you can travel with skis, you know, like what you're supposed to do. And you're supposed to have like a bag that you can put your ski equipment in, because, you know, it'd be really strange to just you know, everyone putting their skis there, and then afterwards having to try and find out, you know, whose skis they are and stuff like that. So it's just very, it was very strange to me to watch, you know, these commuters, passengers, whatever you want to call them, just walking around holding their skis over their shoulder, you know, and not hitting anybody at the same time.
It was the '90s. It was a different time.
Yes, that's very true.
I just spotted there's a lady carrying skis at as well.
Yes. Yeah. There's this, it's during their conversation. You see a girl in a purple jacket that she's also holding them. But again, it just doesn't look like that's the way that they would be, you know, putting them. And then you also see that there's a guy right in front of her that has a ripped red bag. And you see that it's like ripped open. So I guess it shows that, you know, he really was running for his life at that point, and then it ended up getting ripped along the way.
Oh yeah, okay, I saw the ripped bag.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And then John runs.
I was watching the movie, and when the panic starts to hit the airport, and people start to run out of the airport in the previous couple minutes, I you know, paid attention to the crowd and noticed like people getting knocked down and not trampled, but definitely like full on panic mode as they were running through the airport. So yeah, no surprise that this guy's shopping bag with looks like stuff full of presents got damaged.
Yeah, seriously. You know, and then John like wades his way through this crowd, passing the girl in the lavender coat, and then the scene cuts, and we get to see Thornburg, you know, once again, back in the bathroom, talking on the phone. And
right before that cut, I noticed the score here, and it, you know, I can tell without having to look it up that this was definitely another Michael Kamen, you know, score movie. I know he did the first one, but the actual horns that are being played here right as it cuts, it's like it's building tension right as it cuts on John running towards Sam. Those particular horns and the way they're played sound very much like a scene in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves during the kind of the final action set piece when he's trying to rescue all of his men from the gallows, and you know, stuff's getting blown up around him, and he's like, Robin's about to fire an arrow, one of the hero shots, like in that build up, those same horns are being used. So it's like they just stood out to me as very recognizable, obviously Michael Kamen. So
yeah, okay,
it's kind of a nice little treat.
Yeah, I love Michael Kamen. I think he did some amazing music. I mean, one of my favorite is From the Earth to the Moon. I don't know if you've ever heard that. The score from the Earth to the Moon always gets me. It's just amazing. And obviously, I loved what he did here in Die Hard also. And you know, the list is really long of Michael Kamen stuff.
Oh yeah, I got one more thing on this airport location. Before we cut over you get that wide shot with everyone kind of running around, and I got to wondering, like, you know, where this location was, because obviously it's being shot at night. I figured it was being shot outside. I didn't think they were going to build like an airport, you know, location like this for a couple shots. And I looked up in IMDb and noticed that they'd used Stapleton International Airport in Denver and Los Angeles International. Those were both stand-ins for Dulles. And so I looked up Stapleton International Airport Die Hard, and I found like someone took on-set photos like as an amateur, you know, like just happened to be there while they were filming back in
1989, 90, right.
And he posted them to some web, kind of a very amateur like website that he maintained. You can see like they were setting up for the shot when they're dealing with the car being towed, but it's very obviously this same location. Yeah. So it's kind of cool. I can share that website with you later if you want the.
Oh, that would be really cool.
Some of those on set photos.
Yeah, that would be very cool. I mean, on the commentary, Randy Harlan talks about the fact how some of these shots were really, really difficult to do. And he said that all the stuff they did here in the airport, they did it like 4 o'clock in the morning. And they still were told that they had to be quiet and be nice to the people without screaming at them at that hour. Okay. So,
yeah,
you know, it sort of makes sense. Yeah. So, and again, fake snow. None of it's real, even in Denver.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what can you do with that?
Yeah.
And then so now the shot changes and we're back on the plane with Thornburg. And thankfully, I mean, I don't know if you noticed this, but last week we talked about the fact that in all the scenes last week when he was talking on the phone was actually upside down. He was talking into the headpiece instead of the receiver. And now they've switched it back. I remember noticing this when I first saw the movie, that it was really weird. I mean, this was when this movie, or not long after this movie came out, was when IMDb started. I can't remember what year IMDb started, but I remember looking up all the different, you know, goofs on IMDb at the time, stuff like that. And I remember also a news article at the time that was talking about the goofs. You know, like at the beginning of the movie, you see that it says Pacific Bell when he's on the phone, because it was filmed in LAX. You know, and Rennie Harland even acknowledges it on the commentary that he just never paid attention to the fact that, you know, that there would be a different name of the phone company, you know, in different areas of the country and stuff like that. And so this was another thing that I always noticed, the fact that he was holding the phone upside down. So, but here he's got it right back up. And he continues with his diatribe. And he goes, but at least the truth is not among the hostages, because I, Richard Thornburg, just happened to be here. And he stands up as he's talking, and you see him like looking at in the mirror.
The stand up is nice.
Yeah, and he's looking in the mirror at himself, and he goes, to put his life and talent on the line for humanity and country. And I mean, it's just great the way that he says it, to put his life and talent on the line, you know, for humanity and country. That you know, it made me think that he's just being very narcissistic with that, the way that he's looking at himself. He's so proud of himself. He really thinks that he's doing something right here. And you know, we know that he isn't. You know, and I don't know how he's actually helping the country, or forget about humanity, but even let's just go on a smaller scale. How is he helping the country by telling everybody that there are terrorists that have taken over the airport? I don't know. I'm a little confused about that. You know, and they give us a great shot, because we see his face as he's talking, and we see behind him the door to the bathroom open up, and then we see Holly standing there, and the stewardess that he had a lot of problems with at the time, obviously. You know, the two of them are just standing there, and you know, we're not sure what's going to happen. We saw Holly last week, you know, take the taser. But, you know, we don't really see what's going to happen. I think it's done in a way that you're not supposed to notice that that's what she's really doing at the time, until you get the shock when she's opening the door, you know, and like, okay, how is she there? You know, you know, and the first thing that went through my mind is this legal for them to open up the bathroom door? You know, like, is it something that you're allowed to do? I mean, I know that.
I'm guessing that Richard will have a pretty decent case here for a lawsuit.
Another lawsuit.
The airport, you know, when it's all said and done.
Probably.
But I guess it makes sense.
If he remembers.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the airplane staff would have to have a way to open the door. I guess I can go with that. Like, in a medical emergency, they would have to be able to get that door open. But yeah, initially I was a little surprised that
I looked up online to see if I didn't look about the legality of whether you're allowed to open it up or not, but then apparently, you know, they have like a no smoking sign that's on the bathroom door, and that if you can like move that away, and then there's a latch that they can use to unlock or lock the door from the outside if needed. Apparently in different airplanes, it's a, you know, it's located in different places. Some places there's like a silver lavatory sign that's there, and it's behind it. And the, you know, the flight attendants are able to to either get in or get out,
yeah,
or open up if they need to, or get in or lock it, you know, if they really need to, with that type of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I always knew that there was a way to do it, because it would be really stupid. It's not like you know, the school bathrooms where if you needed, you know, where kids would lock it and then, like, you know, crawl underneath in order to get out. So, and then in order to open it, you had to crawl back under, that type of thing. But I don't know. It makes sense, but I don't know the legality of it.
It's also a little strange that Holly takes matters into her hands here, you know.
Well, they needed to give her something to do here.
Yeah. I feel like it's kind of just the going for the reoccurring bit of her being the one to knock out Dick, but
Thornburg. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, apparently, you know, he's her foil. He's more of her foil than John's foil.
Sure.
You know, John deals with the terrorists and she deals with the journalist.
Yeah.
You know, so it sort of makes sense. And then she just like taps him and just zaps him. And, you know, they give us a great shot of her zapping him in the way that he, like, flails backwards.
Yeah.
And then he falls back and just lands sitting on the toilet, you know. And as she's being zapped, he has this final line of the minute. And he goes, and if this should be my final broadcast,
what do you think he would have followed that up with?
Probably saying, and if this should be my final broadcast, you know that I'm here for everyone else, or something to that effect. You know, he would be saying something that he's not doing this for himself.
Right. That's pretty
you
close.
Know, continuing to, with what he said about, you know,
pretty close to what I had.
Putting his life and talent.
I think he was going to say, know that I'm happy knowing it was to fight terrorism and save lives. Something to that effect. Pretty close to what you were saying.
Yeah. Something to that effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a great point for her to zap him. And then, you know, then Holly just looks over and goes, amen to that.
Yeah.
Which is a great way. It also ends the minute.
No, it's a perfect ending for a minute. Did you talk about the stun gun when it was first introduced?
We talked a little bit about it, yes, but if there's something you want to say about it,
okay.
I'm sure people have forgotten it. It's been, you know, months since we talked about it. So
only that it's very much it feels like it's from that era. It's the same stun gun that appears in Batman Returns,
mm-hmm.
Or at least same shape. It looks identical to it anyways.
Well, I think it was also 1990. Come on. Oh, that was 92.
Yeah.
Batman Returns was 92.
92, so. But yeah, same. It looks to be the Omega stun gun. So I don't have details about the gun itself.
Yeah, no, I didn't look up specifically which one it was.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I think that's the one it is, but.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, just it stood out to me as being a very 90s. Stun gun. If you were going to see a stun gun in a movie or TV show, it was going to be this one.
Right.
So
I guess it was easy to animate the electricity, you know, you know, showing in between the two points on it, you know, when you would zap someone, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. All right. You have anything else for this minute before we get into the script?
Only that movies like this, and I mean almost any movie with an airplane set, I buy I never feel in this movie that I'm not on an airplane when I'm seeing these people. And I feel like it has a lot to do that they're in these scenes on the airplane. It feels like there's always like a white noise kind of engine hum in the background.
Oh wow.
And it's very like anytime I'm ever on a plane, I notice, you know, that hum that's on a plane. And they do it here in the movie too. Anytime you're on the plane, you got that white noise, and it never feels like I'm on a set in this movie. And I don't know, obviously they are because of the way they have to get in to film in that bathroom little section and everything. But
right on the, on the commentary, so Rennie Harlan mentions that all this, the internal scenes of the planes were done on a set, and the external scenes of the planes were all models, except for, we'll get to it later this week, there's one that's not a model.
Sure.
But I mean, it makes sense to do it that way. But you're right; it de
Totally.
definitely makes you feel as if you're on the plane. You do hear the humming. I've noticed that. I've never pointed it out because to me it was just like, okay, they're on a plane. That's
It's
the way
just
it should be.
there.
That's
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, they did that. They
Yeah.
did that well. All right. So the script.
But yeah, that's all I've got.
Okay. So the script starts off with it says new angle. Lorenzo's car smashes into a taxi. Camera cranes up, and we see that the police cars have run amok. Have run smack into the panic in front of the airport. Lorenzo shouts, barking orders. Move that piece of shit! Henderson, get some crowd control. God damn it, clear the area. McLean jumps out of the car, looks around, and sees Sam in the terminal, watching the scene, trying to get it on video. And then it goes, we talked about this last week, it intercuts back to when Holly is going and taking the taser from the bag. So that's part of what it talks about there. And then it continues with Thornburg in the laboratory. And then he pretty much says the exact same thing. He goes, and so it continues. A standoff between terrorists and authorities with the lives of thousands at stake. But at least this time in this place, the truth at least is not among the hostages, because Richard Thornburg put his life and his talent on the line for humanity and country. Behind him, Holly silently opens the laboratory door. And if this should be my final broadcast, wham, she zaps him with the old lady's taser. He twitches, drops. She picks up the phone. Amen to that, Adam. Into the phone, sweetly. We're sorry, but Mr. Thornburg is experiencing electrical problems. We now resume our regular programming. So, I mean, it's funny, but I don't think it's needed. You know, I'm glad they cut that out. It works well the way that they did it here.
Sure.
That's for sure. All right, so every Monday we have a segment called McLean Monday, where my guests will give their top five Bruce Willis performances. So, Travis, why don't you start off with number five and work your way up?
Okay. Number five, I will say, is a movie I think is I never hear anybody ever talk about. It's Mercury Rising. I think it's probably from 1998, maybe. Somewhere
around
there.
I think it was 98, yes. You're actually not the first person to mention it.
Okay.
Yes.
It's just a good, like, he's got to protect a little kid from, you know, the kid ends up,
that's right,
a little autistic kid who figures out a you know, NSA level code. And yeah, he just has to protect this kid. It's a solid movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you haven't seen it, I really recommend it. My next one would be, I think I got to go with Unbreakable. I know
I would think that you would have that higher.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a movie I love. It's not one I revisit that often. But yeah, really, it's just a solid movie that I love. And I picked it over like a Sixth Sense. Not that I couldn't have both of them here, but I chose to spread out my list a little bit and only go with one of the Bruce Willis, M. Night kind of movies.
Okay.
And I went with Unbreakable for just because of the... I went into that movie. I saw that one in a theater, had no expectations other than now knowing, like, okay, it's a M. Night Shyamalan movie with Bruce Willis. There's going to be something, you know, twist or something, and really knew nothing about that one going into it. And yeah, I just loved it. Next, I would put, I think one of the funniest movies, especially funniest Bruce Willis movies, is The Whole Nine Yards. I think that movie just has some of the funniest moments in it, especially the way that Bruce Willis is played off of Matthew Perry.
Mm-hmm.
I think those two work so well in that movie together.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the sequel.
It just feels – I'm not either. But yeah, Whole Nine Yards, I think, is just – it's a comedy that feels like it did some different things that hadn't been done – you know, for many years in the comedy genre, you know, in the time that it came out.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
Solid movie. I think, man, now it's a toss up between one and two. I got to put, I'll go with Fifth Element for number two, just cause that's a perfect movie and he's amazing in it. I can't say anything bad about that movie. I love Fifth Element. And then number one would be Die Hard with a Vengeance. So.
Yeah, well, I figured that you'd say that after prefacing it earlier this earlier today's episode. So I knew that that's where you were going with that one. Great. All
right.
Excellent. So, Travis, you want to tell people where they can find you?
Sure. As Rob said up at the top, I'm working on Minute of Thieves. That is the movie by minutes breakdown of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And when I say I'm working on it, I literally mean I'm working on that. There's no release date as of this moment. There's no release date set. I'm just trying to bank up as many episodes as I can, get as much of the movie recorded as possible before I start to release. But it's coming soon. I will say that, look forward to it, and should be fun.
And look around for it, because maybe you've already seen it. Maybe it's already out in October.
Rob's been a guest already, so you'll have his minutes to look forward to. And I'm working on that. Minute of Thieves is pretty much the, you search that, I think you'll find me on there pretty easily. And that's what I'll plug for now.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, or you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here and